Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
My name is Will. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Will.
It's good to be here. Thanks for asking me, guys, and yeah, I know some of you here, and I'm going to know some of you more in a little bit. So, my sobriety date is June 14th, 2011. My home group is Empire Way. I have a sponsor. Thanks, Jerry. My home group is Empire Way. I have a sponsor in a service position, and I get to be around this great fellowship and amazing people all the time, actually. Probably a little bit too much, but it's fun anyways. For me, I'm going to try to focus on recovery, the solution part of recovery, rather than my story. I'm going to try to limit my drunkalogue, but we'll see how that goes. I grew up a ways from here. I grew up in northern Maine, on the coast, and my family was always supportive of me. My family was always there for me when I needed to. They supported me, not just financially, just emotionally and every other facet. But I always found a way to be different. Like for me, growing up as an adopted child, I was kind of used to like feeling like the odd one out, even though I'm pretty much like your typical American kid. I still found a way to make myself a little bit different or make myself feel a little bit different than everyone else. And that, I believe, is what makes me an alcoholic. Yes, of course, I have the allergy. Yes, of course, I have all the mental obsessions when I'm not working a program. But that feeling of differentness, that feeling of I don't belong here, I need some way to find some way to get out of the situation. And I'm not looking to do like the step work or the work to get rid of it. I want that instant solution. It doesn't matter what that solution is. I'll find a way to get that instant solution if I'm not together with a power greater than myself and a fellowship around me that's willing to call me on my shit, because I can very easily convince myself that I'm not an alcoholic if I'm not willing to do the stuff I'm asked. It's very easy for me to obsess about things and to be that same person. I'm perfectly capable of being that same person that I was coming into the program. And I remember the last year or so of my, before I came in, was actually one of the more successful in terms of on-paper stuff for me, and that's just the way my story went. I was doing decently in school. I was okay with socializing, but not, like, giving myself over to anything else. I actually had a spiritual mentor that I was seeing the last 6 months before I came in, and thank God, because I probably would have killed myself if I didn't, but I thought I had things taken care of. I thought I had what I needed to survive in this world, or even just make it through day by day, but in reality, I woke up every morning needing a drink or a drug to get me through. I was a maintenance drinker from age probably 15. I'd drink in the morning, I'd drink at night. I would bring in a water bottle full of vodka to class in high school. That isn't normal behavior. That isn't what most kids do, come to find out at least. And I continued with that. Like, I thought everything was all right just because I could accomplish a couple of things, and I was blessed with skills to make it by, and to be able to at least meet the status quo, and that was my life. Even though I knew that I had potential, let's say, I was okay with just, like, doing the bare minimum and not really taking a look on where my problems really lied. And I paid for that. I was in a cabin in Vermont the last year, and we didn't turn on the heat, so I would be huddled up with my bottle of scotch or my bottle of whatever, huddled up in the corner trying to figure out how I was going to make it outside the rest of to just handle things in the world. And I wasn't willing to really do anything about it other than, like, consult with my friend and complain and just be in my own shit. A friend of mine talks about the shit blanket that I surround myself with, and and that's true. That's so true. It was so comfy for me, even though I knew it wasn't really, it didn't smell very good. And I couldn't get out of my own way. So that's what it was like when I was coming in. I wasn't really even prepared to have my life change like that. I think it was supposed to happen that way. It was my last couple of days were spent at home, drinking in my room and trying to figure out how I was gonna get out of there. And I hit my bottom on the night of June 13th, going into the night of the 14th, and I ended up in the hospital. I ended up in the hospital in a blackout, and I spent 3 days there being evaluated by the psych unit at the hospital. And I thought just because I could read the entire 164 pages of the Big Book in those 2 days that I was going to be all right. I was going to have the knowledge to get through, like, all of the stuff that was keeping me back. And I thought that I could just get by again. I just needed to prove to the doctors that I didn't have a problem. And needless to say, they didn't buy what I was trying to sell them. They knew this wasn't my first trip to the hospital, I'll say that much. And they knew me better than I did at the time. And I think that was a turning point, but there were many others to come for sure. I got into the program via treatment. I went into treatment from that point, and I spent 30 days in Arizona and another 90 days or 5 months in Port Townsend. And I met a group of guys that I could relate with, guys who were my age that knew they had a problem, or at least were in the same place with similar problems. And I found that with that group of friends that we were still crazy. We were still crazy as hell, man. But I knew that these were my people. I knew that these were the people that I could rely on and begin to become right with myself and right with other people. And thankfully, I wasn't really ready to work the steps yet. I kind of faked my way through. My first fifth step was, I mean, I gave it a full effort, but I wasn't as honest as I could be. And I withheld a couple of things, and I did the best I could, I guess, but I didn't get anything out of it. I actually was left empty after my first fifth step with my sponsor, and I didn't know who I was or what I was supposed to do after I did that. I heard a lot of people talking about their fifth steps and how what an amazing experience it was supposed to be, and, like, get all this weight off me, and that just wasn't me, at least that first time. Going forward, I moved out here, stayed out here in Seattle, met a group of young people around Capitol Hill, rolled with them for a while, got a service position, eventually worked the steps in earnest, and found out that my problems were based around my fears and my unwillingness to address that and remain scared. I remember the first Christmas party that I went to, I hid in the corner away from people because I didn't know how to relate. I didn't trust that I could be open and honest with them, so I just hid. I just hid in the corner, talked to like one or two people the entire night, and wasn't willing to do anything other than that. Going forward, I can't believe the things that have happened since then. Like I've lived in multiple different places. I've went back to school and graduated. I moved back to my house, back to my parents' house, 2 years after I got clean, and was absolutely lost. I had completely lost track, and this was in sobriety. I lost track of where I wanted to go or even what to do. That happens. That's real shit that I go through. Even now, like, I needed those moments of I can't handle this. I can't do it on my own. And to come through that, to work through it, it may take a while. It took me a while. It takes me a while still to work through stuff. But what I do know is the fact that there are people in this room that understand me. There's people in this room that are willing to support me when those things go wrong. And when they don't, I have step work and service work and other things to distract me from the crazy stuff that goes in my head. I have a amazing group of friends that will show up when I don't, even when I don't want them. they show up. And this goes outside of the program too. Like, I have friends now. I've been able to start building like a community here in Seattle, and I've started to like be more willing to open myself up to the possibility that I may not know where I'm supposed to go, but I know that if I stay on a certain path within these, based around me staying sober and creating the fellowship that I crave, that I will be all right. And I really do have an amazing life. I get to go different places with different people and end up in weird spots and end up and watch people come in and see that light come on again. And see people with multiple years of sobriety that are struggling and help them work through it. And see myself go through some stuff and work through it too. I get to see a lot of not even miracles. I don't like using the word miracles, but like a lot of God moments, let's say, where I watch a person work through their steps, do a little bit of service work, and start to enjoy things again. And I need that. I need that constant reminder. And I get to try different things out. I get to try to work through those difficult moments. And I don't know where I'd be if I didn't have that. Like, if I didn't have what I have today or what I have had the other, or like what I had when I first got here, I don't know where I'd be. And I don't have to even worry about that because I'm supported and I've got the things that I need. Even if I'm going through shit, it's all right. I can make it through without having to drink or use or do anything other than do a little inventory and share it with people and be okay with that. So it's good to be here. Thank you guys for asking me.
Janaki alcoholic.
Hi, Janaki.
My sobriety date is April 18th, 1986. I have a sponsor. I do not have a home group. I participate in the meetings that I go to. But I was raised in Los Angeles, and we didn't have a sort of a home group culture. And I went to 12 meetings a week for my first many years of sobriety and basically had a commitment to virtually all of them. So AA is my home group. I was an alcoholic, I think, from the moment I was born. I really felt from a very young age that there wasn't anything that I could do to function in the world the way other people did. I didn't feel safe. I didn't feel safe unless my door was closed and the lights were off. And that's the way my childhood was. I didn't do well in school. They used to chase me around. I was this classic underachiever, really smart, but I was afraid to study. I was afraid to do anything. And I really felt that no matter what I did, I was never going to get over. I was never going to have what you had. So, and I was raised in New York during the sex, drugs, and rock and roll era. And when, in my teens, when I discovered drugs and alcohol, that was my answer. I knew my life was unmanageable, clearly, and my coping mechanism was being high 24 hours a day. I mean, I have a lot of ins and outs of my story. At one point, I lived in a yoga ashram, looking for another way to not live in the world. So my drug became religion. I had moderate successes in career, but every time I would just sort of leave and undermine myself. I did everything I could to prove that I was a loser, to prove that belief that I had, that I was stupid and a loser. And that wound me up in California, in Los Angeles, one more time. I used to think that I would have like a little bit of a chance if I had a career and was successful in that way. But as I said, I couldn't do that either. I had friends, but I had no intimates. The way I related to men was through sex. The way I related to women was not at all. I mean, I had friends, but everybody I knew got high on one thing or another all the time. So I honestly never really had a relationship. Pretty pathetic, huh? Oh my God, I feel so sorry for myself. Anyway, I recognized that I had a problem, so I was pursuing moderation. And as I was approaching my 39th birthday, I was also in therapy, And my sponsor, my therapist said to me something about my drinking, and I said, okay, I'll make a deal with you. I won't get high one day a week. And this is the way the program works. For some reason, I think it had to do with the look of horror on her face. But I heard that, and it occurred to me that there might be some sort of a correlation. So I started going to AA and using meetings as a system of reward. And at one point, I ran into somebody who I knew from New York, and I'm not going to tell that story. Because you put this on the web, and I'm not supposed to curse, and so I don't want to talk about sex and, you know, that kind of stuff. So I'm going to try to keep it clean. I'm a Bronx girl from the streets, you know. The fact that I come from a nice Jewish family in the Bronx means nothing. Anyway, so he asked me if I was willing to get sober, and I said, no, you just don't understand. My life is so painful that I can't do it. And he asked me if I was willing to become willing. I just love this about AA. Because that was that, when they talk about it in the big book about the third step, you just open the door to willingness, just the tiniest bit. And it wasn't an intellectual thing. I said, well, yeah, sure, I'm smart. I'd like to be willing, but I'm not. And for reasons that I continue to not be able to explain, I got home that night and I did not get high. And the next day was April 18th, 1986. As you might well imagine, I was crazy as a bed bug. I often say I didn't know whether to do my nails or move to Guam. I went to this meeting 5 mornings a week at a place called the Log Cabin where you know, you just sort of yelled and screamed the whole time. I didn't trust anybody. There's something wonderful about early sobriety when you find your people who are as crazy as you are, yet for some reason committed to stay sober, because the other thing is drinking and using is not going to work anymore. I had no faith in the program, but no understanding of it. But it was comforting to hang around these people who were just as crazy as I was. And sharing from the podium didn't feel intimate to me, because you were there and I was here and I could say anything I wanted. Anyway, I've never been able to fully explain that difference, but be that as it may. I had a very difficult time making commitments, and I was at this other meeting and somebody asked me if I had a big book, and I said, well, no, I don't want to make that kind of investment until I know I want to say. I didn't know how much a big book was. And he looked at me, he said, big book, it's $4. It was a long time ago. So I bought a big book, and then they kept saying, sponsor, 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 sponsor. And I went, no, 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 no. I couldn't make a commitment to anybody, and I just had no way to do that. I just couldn't do that. So this one woman who was very nice, I said, well, would you be my temporary sponsor? I could do that, because I didn't know what I needed. And I was 30 days sober then. When I was 31 days sober, that was a Sunday. It was on a Sunday, and I went to this morning meeting. And this woman shared. And the earth moved. She told a remarkable story. And I think the only thing I heard was that she went back to school. And I barely went to school. I barely graduated. And I always thought I was stupid because I didn't go to college and this kind of stuff. Anyway, so I literally went up to her trembling. And I asked her for her number. And the next day, I called her. Now, I did the newcomer trick of calling her at home, knowing she'd be at work. So I didn't actually have to talk to her. Little did I know, she actually had a program, checked her machine, and called me back. So I had to talk to her, and I started talking to her and telling her that, asking her about school and saying that I wanted to go back to school. And she asked me how much sobriety I had. And I told her 32 days. And when she stopped laughing, she didn't laugh. But I know she was laughing in her mind. But she was very patient and continued to talk to me and then asked me if I would call her back at 1 o'clock. And I said, sure. I wasn't going to call her back because I couldn't call anybody back. And again, I called her back. If I'm going to give you an image of what I felt like, it was like a little bird who had been soaked in water, a baby bird who had been soaked in water and put up on the shore, frightened and shivering. That's how I felt. And that's how I felt every single second of the day. And I called her back. And I called her every single day at the same time for the next 8 years. It was 8:30 in the morning, and the phone would ring. Everybody in her office would say, oh, it's Janaki. And she became my sponsor. I was not capable of continued effort, so at 33 days, I told her I wanted to do my fourth step. she said, I have to get everything done really quickly. And she said, well, what are you going to do when you finish? And I said, well, I'll hover. I mean, I was out of my mind. But she told me a few things when she agreed to be my sponsor. That first, she knew that I didn't think the program was going to work. And she told me to hitch my wagon to her star. She told me that no matter what I did, she was never going to throw me away. She told me that she was not my friend. She was my family. She told me she would never tell me what to do, regardless of how much I would beg, and believe me, I begged. She told me she didn't care if I did what she suggested. My program was up to me. She was there to share her experience, strength, and hope, and guide me in the steps. So I started writing at 60 days. And I went, I used to call her my Our Lady of the Perpetual Fourth Step because, I mean, clearly at 60 days, the only thing I knew how to do was point the finger. And we did countless fours through sevens, countless. She would try to point me in the direction because I had no clue as to what my part was. I remember victim martyrs are very tough nuts to crack, especially loser victim martyrs. And so she tried to explain self-seeking behavior. I remember we did this fifth step at this particular one, and she tried to explain to me what self-seeking behavior was. And I really wanted to know, and I listened, and I listened, and I listened. And she finished explaining it, and I'd say, yeah, well, okay, so what's self-seeking behavior? I mean, that's how thick I was. She would say things to me, and like a month later, something would occur to me, and I would say this to her. And of course, it's exactly what she had told me a month before, or 2 months before. But she was infinitely patient. And I made some, I made some progress. I made some headway. And a lot of the, just like the first speaker, when I did my first fifth step, the only thing that happened was I was very much aware of what I was like and how difficult it was for me to, it all came right to the surface, and I didn't really get very much relief in 6 and 7. And but slowly, I would tell her things, and let me just cut to this part. I was supposed to do a fifth step with her, and I was supposed to be at her house at a certain time, and she asked if I would come an hour or so later because there was something she wanted to do with somebody else first. Well, I said okay, but I was crestfallen. You know, I felt cast aside. I felt that something was more important than I was, and I was very, very hurt. And again, here is where the beginning of orienting to the program really is quite the miracle. Generally speaking, if something that like that happens, I'm gone. I mean, I can leave like that. I mean, I can make an about face and you will never see me again. But I went to do the fifth step, and I sat there, and I just blurted out how my feelings were hurt. And that, it hurt me very deeply. And she came over to me and put her arms around me. She made a sincere amends right on the spot. That wasn't the issue. And she came over to try to comfort me, and I felt I couldn't. I was like this. I couldn't surrender myself to her. And that's when I had this really deep experience of how removed I was, how I could not be intimate with another human being. It was and that's the only way I've ever learned anything in Alcoholics Anonymous, by the way. I didn't learn it from reading it in a book. People say something to me and it resonates, but deep shifts or realizations for me only comes from me experiencing it personally, and usually in a painful way. Anyway, a week later, I was meeting her at a meeting, and I was having an attack of alcoholism. And I don't remember how, I had to have been somewhere within my first 3 years of sobriety at this point. And she was down at the end of the block, and I saw her, and I went running toward her, and I threw myself into her arms. And I made a connection. It was my first connection. She was my first connection to the world. And that kind of opened the floodgates for me. And it got to a point where I could literally tell her everything. You know, even the secret stuff, what I secretly want, bad things to happen to other people, or how I'm secretly happy when I shouldn't be. I mean, you know, that real nook and cranny crap that sometimes I would prefer to pretend I'm too spiritual for. But I got to tell her everything. And when I was about to embark on some self-destructive behavior for a change, she wouldn't say, you know, you might rethink that. She would say, fine, I'll be here with the dustpan and broom when you get back. And each one of those experiences were crucial to my reformation. The first recognition of what my part was. Again, I did endless 4, 5, 6, and 7, endless ones. Was when, I don't remember how sober I was, but it was about around a year, and I did yet another inventory, and finally I hit the bottom and broke through. during 6 and 7. Because you had to do 6 and 7 right after 5. You go home, sit for an hour, reread it. She was adamant about that, and she's absolutely right, because it's up there, and if I let it go down, I don't have access to it anymore. And so if we finally 6 and 7 worked, and I recognized that I wore my victim martyr cape like a self-protecting cloak. And as long as that was who I was, then I didn't have to do anything else. There was nothing else I needed to do. It was my excuse. And that wasn't who I was. And as a result, I realized that, you know what? I'm free to behave any way I want. I mean, I can experiment and do whatever I want. And there was that beautiful taste of freedom that I felt. Of course, subsequent to that, I went to bed for 3 months because the whole idea of having no constraints was too much for me to bear, too. But over the years, I've had a really good life. Some really wonderful things have happened, and some absolutely horrible things have happened. My relationship with my sponsor, as generally happens over time, I no longer spoke to her every single day, but I did speak to her. I did do inventories with her. The relationship got a little bit more balanced, and she went through some very difficult times herself, and her husband died, and she had some, she was born with physical problems, and she's been plagued with physical problems, and there were times that I sat as sponsor to her, which is something that I was really happy to do. And my life began to include other people in a more intimate way. I still rarely, now I have done fifth steps with other people, but I rarely did fifth steps with anybody other than Penny, formal fifth steps, but I could talk to my friends in the program and some other people who I know in and around my 11th step work, and I could be intimate, and I could reveal my soft center. I could reveal my shame. I could actually be honest. And as painful as that is, and again, I'm not going to be able to explain this accurately, but there's an ecstatic quality about being that open. You know, it's like, so instead of that shivering little bird, everything kind of relaxes and disappears. You know, it's sort of like there's no difference, there's no separation between you and me when I can actually do that. And what you do with that is not my business. It's and it's been a really wonderful thing. I'm 29 and a half years sober, going on 30 years sober, and I still have that same sponsor. She lives in California. I live here. And she's dying. She's in hospice, and she made the decision not to seek treatment for the multiple things that are wrong with her, and I have no way of objecting to that. That's her decision. But I call her mom. She's my nurturing parent. And it's very, very painful. But I was talking to her the other day, and I was telling her about a few things that I've started to do, and I started doing this, floating in sensory deprivation tanks and this and that and the other thing. And she said to me, and here she is in hospice care, and she says, "Oh, so you're finally doing something for yourself." And that sank in so deeply, and it's the And I was telling Pam and Lorelei, you only get that from somebody who has known you so deeply and so intimately for all this time. I got to tell you, I still don't believe she's going to die. I can't believe she's going to die. Lorelei and I, Penny used to sponsor Lorelei too. And she and I are flying down there next Saturday. And we're going to see her on Saturday. And then I'm flying right back. She's staying at Holiday. I'm not. and I have to say, I'm really nervous about seeing her. I call her regularly, but I'm really nervous about calling her. And even today, you know, I like it when she doesn't answer and I can just leave a message. Because, I mean, even though I have attended other people's deaths, I mean, I'm not squeamish about death, but I'm squeamish about her. This is different. And I'm unsure about how to be. I feel uncomfortable talking to her directly about her own death. And I feel really awkward about it. And I'm very nervous about seeing her. But what I do know is that any way I am when I go there is going to be okay. It's fine. Because she loves me, and she knows that I love her. And we can probably just sit there and not say anything, although she's a tough nut, my sponsor. And she'll probably be ordering me around the room. But what Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me is to show up and to do it and to go. I got to tell you, I don't want to go. And when this first happened, the first thing I said was, I can't go. I can't afford to go. I'm not going to go. It's inconvenient to go. But I've been sober long enough to know that I can't not go. And so I'm not sure what this pitch was about. I do know is that I can't talk about anything that's not current for me. And I've actually been talking about this a little bit because it's been going on for a month or so. And I want to thank you all for indulging me. And that's it. Thanks.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.